Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Monty Walden. How are you, Monty?
Pretty good, Chris.
Excellent, excellent. And one of the nice things about yourself is that you're the Tuscan chair of Decanter's, what is it called, Decanter Wine Awards?
Decanter World Wine Awards. Yeah, I'm a regional, my official title is Regional Chair for Tuscany, which basically just means I sit at the edge of the table and can sort of tell people what to do.
Really?
I'm joking.
No, of course you don't tell people what to do. They follow what you just say without mentioning.
Well, no, we're all sort of in debate. We all have our own judgments. And I suppose you have a casting vote, but I like judging to sort of be consensual rather than the other way around, basically.
No, that's cool. What I want to do today is I want to talk about Tuscany and central Italy. Italy is one of those regions a lot of people struggle with. And central Italy is not so bad because, you know, people have heard of Chianti a bit. But my goodness me, there's a lot of great varieties and regions in central Italy, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, Italy, they don't really make it easy when they could just have sort of one regional appellation. They sort of have about 10, Chianti being a prime example.
Yeah.
You've got Chianti, Chianti Classico, Chianti Classico Reserva. And then you've got all the sub-regions like Rufina and Corripisane. And it is just desperately, desperately difficult for people to wade through that and to make any sense of it.
Well, is there an easy way to remember or think about central Italy?
Probably the main thing to remember is almost all red wines will be Sangiovese-based. It's the most widely planted grape in Italy, and its homeland is central Italy.
Yep.
So really, unless it says Cabernet Merlot on the label, it's going to contain Sangiovese.
Okay, and then Trebbiano is another big one, is it?
Yeah, I suppose in Tuscany, probably the two main grapes are Vernaccia from Vernaccia di San Gimignano and Vermentino, which is found on the coast, which is a little bit like a slightly more exotic version of Chardonnay. Trebbiano tends to be found further east in Emilia-Romagna, where you have Trebbiano, and in Abruzzo, where you have more Trebbiano there. Generally, in Tuscan wine, you kind of find it sometimes in Vinsanto, or as a minor blending grape for those people that still use it in their Chiantis, along with other white grapes as well. And that was one of the reasons why the Super Tuscans came about, was because you weren't sort of legally allowed to make 100% Sangiovese as a Chianti in the early 70s, but you had to add white grapes to your Chianti. So that was where the whole Super Tuscan thing started.
Well, let's start at the top and work our way down. All right, so the first region is Emilia-Romagna.
Okay, that's basically sort of central, north central Italy.
It's sort of on the east coast.
Yep, on the east coast. So it's on the Adriatic Sea, whereas Tuscany's on the Tyrrhenian. It's both Mediterranean, but Tuscany's on the sort of left-hand side, if you like, and Emilia-Romagna is on the right-hand side. And generally speaking, Emilia-Romagna has a slightly easier topography to understand. It's fairly flat. And really the most famous wine from that region, or infamous wine from that region, is Lambrusco, which traditionally is actually a fizzy red wine, or a slightly fizzy red wine. Now, I really like Lambrusco. When I worked in Bottoms Up, a wine shop in the early 1990s, you know, we used to sell these terribly horrible Lambrusco fizzy wines.
And it's sweet sometimes, isn't it?
Well, they are sweet, or they can be sweet. I actually find them, in modern times, a little bit more savoury, but they're fantastic food wines. The main sort of cooking style in Emilia-Romagna is a lot of pork, so you have a lot of salami. And if you're going to eat a sort of quite fatty piece of meat, a Lambrusco is a perfect drink to wash it down with.
And is that the main wine from
Emilia? Yeah, well, that's sort of the biggest volume wine, Lambrusco. And then probably the sort of the more sophisticated wines, if you want, is we have the Trebbiano di Romagna for white, but Trebbiano really isn't a very sophisticated grape. But the main one in terms of red would be Sangiovese di Romagna, or in Italian they say Sangiovese di Romagna, which means Sangiovese red wine that comes from the Romagna part of Emilia-Romagna. And these can be extremely good value, and there are a number of producers there producing really quite high quality wines. And they're a good alternative to the big shot Tuscan Sangioveses like Brunello di Montalcino, for example.
Do they have the weight of that, or are they lighter in style?
Not really. They're a little bit more open in texture, and probably a little bit sandier in texture, I would say. Approachable earlier. They're not going to age as well. Some of them will, but not really. They're wines for drinking between, say, 1 and 4 years.
Yep. One of the things I like about I never remember.
Emilia-Romagna.
Yeah, Emilia-Romagna. It's
Romagna.
Romagna.
Think of a girl called Emilia.
Emilia's easy.
Who married a bloke called Romagna.
Romagna. And they were romantically involved.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
Romagna. Emilia-Romagna.
And they had a bottle of Lambrusco on their wedding day.
Yeah, okay, so it went well. There's a region just above that, Veneto.
Veneto. Yeah. Which is Venice, around Venice. I have a beautiful accent up in Veneto. Love
not,
the region.
Not the way I pronounce okay, no. it. There's a region, though. It's the Poo Plain. I know it's not called Poo Plain, but it's about P.O. Plain.
The Plain of the Po.
Plain of the Po.
Yeah, that's actually more...
that's north. I know, that's more... That's
more Emilia-Romagna, actually, I think, the Po
is
Valley.
Is it really?
Yeah, yeah.
It's I just love that name. It's like, what sort of wine come from there?
Po. Yeah, I mean, up in Veneto, that's more sort of Suave territory, and Valpolicella,
exactly,
and things like that. So, Valpolicella is getting certainly for Amarone, which is like a late pick style of Valpolicella with sort of dry grapes. That's becoming very fashionable.
Yeah, it's not central though. So, okay, so the Po Plain, not
the
Poo.
Because
it's quite a flat, open area. And they grow a lot of Cab Sav and Merlots in there as well, don't
they? Yeah, well, you can pretty much grow anything you want. It's not just vines that grow there, but it's other agricultural crops as well. But, it's fertile soil that's easy to farm.
Yeah,
and so that is really why it is known for value wines that don't have a lot of sophistication. Mm. There's nothing wrong with that for everyday drinking, but we're not talking sort of real kind of Grand Cru stuff.
Yep. Okay, most people think of Central Italy though as Tuscany. That's where people's pulses start to get a bit racy and things like that.
Well, I mean, Tuscany sort of derives its name from the Etruscans, and the Etruscans sort of preceded the Greeks, and they effectively were the ones that started growing wine in this part of Italy. They invented the language effectively. Tuscans really do see themselves as the home of Italian culture. It's where the Renaissance happened. The Italian language, it sort of springs from Tuscan, and so they can be quite sort of arrogant in a way, but they feel that, you know what, we're the top dogs. Okay. We sort of invented Italy almost, if you like.
Except for the Romans came from Rome, and they sort of keep taking over every area.
Yeah, that's right. But they kind of they kind of died off the Romans, and then you had the Dark Ages and all that. But the whole idea of the Renaissance, which really shaped modern Europe almost intellectually, it really is this kind of Chianti area was kind of where Florence was where it was taking off. You know.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about Chianti, because that's probably the 10,000-pound gorilla, really, certainly from a volume point of view, would you say? Because I always think of Chianti as being, good quality, or can be, but also it's a big volume-ish type of producer.
Yeah, the trouble with Chianti is you've got wines that are really inexpensive and wines that are really, really expensive. And if you're a normal consumer, it's hard to find your way. Why are these, toothpaste was £1 a tube, and at £50 a tube, you're like, hang on, what's going on with toothpaste?
Yeah.
And that, I suppose, is the problem with Chianti. But yeah, I mean, there are 20 different Chianti styles. Chianti Classico is the sort of historic centre of the region that was delimited in the 1700s. And that does tend to produce the best wines simply because you've got the best soils and the best microclimates. There's a very small region, Chianti Rufina, which also has a very nice little terroir. Towards Pisa, the Collini Pisane, as they said, the Pisa Hills, that's more flat towards the sea, not quite so interesting. Chianti Colli Fiorentini comes from around Florence. You got some nice terroir there, but I wouldn't really ever say that the wines are that much distinctive compared to other Chianti regions. And the probably the biggest one that you would see is Chianti Colli Senesi, which means Chianti from the hills around Siena. And I generally find that to be fairly good value and a pretty good way of introducing yourself to Chianti. And then if you go for Chianti Classico, normally it should be a step up in complexity and interest and depth.
The one I drink a lot of is, we taste a lot with our clients, is Chianti Rufina.
And okay.
That seems to be quite a nice wine. You know, it's quite high in acidity, high in tannins.
Yep.
People always talk about red cherry fruits with Chianti as well, but it seems to be, for me, it seems to be pretty much on the money.
Well, what's interesting about that terroir is you get this night cooling from the range of mountains here called the Apennines or Apennini, and what you get is these cooler winds that sort of start in the north of Italy and also come across the Adriatic, which is a cooler sea than the Tyrrhenian on the left-hand side, if you like. So you get that kind of night cooling and a little bit of elevation in Rufina, or Rufina, as they call it. That's where you're getting those tannins that are a little bit spikier and that acidity that's a little bit more marked. Again, with food, what's not to like?
Yeah, especially tomato foods, because the acidity in the wine sort of balances out the acidity in the tomatoes. Chianti Classico, though, style is still always high tannins, high acidity.
Yeah, although, I mean, traditionally Chianti was actually a wine for the trattoria, the wine for the local restaurant. And it was a gulpable, drinkable wine. Now it's sort of morphed into something more serious. I mean, the trouble with Chianti is You know, what is it? Is it a Frenchified wine that's really is marked by the Cabernet and Merlot that you are allowed to put in there? Or is it a more traditional Sangiovese wine with, say, the local grapes like Malvasia Nera and Canaiolo, that's a little bit, in a way, a little bit softer, a little bit more open knit, and it is more red fruit, whereas the Bordeaux influenced Chiantis are more about black fruit, and they tend to be the ones also that see more new French oak as well. So it's very, very hard to pin down Chianti Classico. What is it? It's a multi-headed hydra.
Okay, so when did they start introducing Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlots into...
Well, that was in the early 70s when one or two producers decided that, you know, it's completely nuts that we are legally obliged to put white grapes into our Chianti. And the reason for that was in the old days...
That was that Trebbiano thing, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, the old days, the vineyards were mixed. You have 10 rows of Sangiovese and one of white grapes on the end. And that was to sort of hedge your bets. And also to lighten the wine, to make this gulpable, drinkable style for lunchtime. You know, people didn't want to get knocked out at lunchtime when they're having their lunch. And then when sort of tastes changed and became a little bit more sophisticated, if you like, the idea of putting white grapes into your red wine seemed completely bonkers. But the law didn't, the bureaucrats didn't change the law. And that's why these guys were sort of protesting almost and saying, right, we are going to make 100% Sangiovese wines and we're going to take them out of the Chianti DOC. And pretty quickly that kind of morphed into, if you know, we're not allowed to put white grapes in, but we're not also allowed to put in French grapes. So then that sort of protest march, if you like, started. And you had famous names that have evolved, like Sassicaia and
Ornellana. But he wasn't Chianti, was he?
No, Sassicaia, well, he was sort of first Super Tuscan. But the idea, he having started or planted Cabernet in the 40s in Bulgari, the idea was, and it seemed to work. And if you're in Chianti and your wines are being described as a little bit weedy, and you're saying, well, yeah, because I've got to put white grapes into them. So, well, why don't you put some Cabernet in? And so the idea there was a sort of a no-brainer almost as a protest. And it's had far, far-reaching ramifications, not just in Tuscany, but also in places like Piemonte and in other areas of Italy, the kind of Frenchification of Italian wine. In a way, I see why they did it. In a way, I kind of think it's a bit of a shame.
One of the things about Sangiovese as a grape variety is that you never get a purple-coloured Sangiovese.
No, I mean, you have a lot of subclones of Sangiovese, and particularly in Brunello, which is a particular subclone of Sangiovese, which gives a slightly more concentrated...
And that's Brunello di Montalcino.
Brunello di Montalcino from the village of, so it means that the Brunello from Montalcino. It doesn't necessarily give a really, really deeply coloured wine, but that doesn't mean to say it doesn't give an intense wine.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Pinot Noir... It doesn't always have a lot of colour, but my God, it can be intense. And I think Sangiovese has been sometimes unfairly criticised for maybe not having the intensity. And that really is just purely down to bad vine growing, often very high yields for these wines that were destined to cooperatives, weedy wines that weren't really ripe. You know, they make wines that aren't particularly easy or pleasurable to drink. So, but if you get Sangiovese right, if you control your yields and you pick it at the right time and you farm it in the right way, it's an incredibly savoury... it's a delicious grape. Mm.
Yeah, savoury, definitely. Especially when it's aged a wee bit. You touched on Brunello di Montalcino. I think that's probably the most famous of the Tuscan wines. You know, they are, when people get excited about wines, they talk about Brunello di Montalcino. And we talked about Cabernet Sauvignon going in there. Bit of a scandal a few years ago about them adding Cab Sav into their wines because... You're not supposed to do it. It's not in the rules. People are doing it and just flogging it off as Brunello di Montalcino. Is that sort of settled down now, or are they going to change the rules to allow it?
No, there have been a number of moves. Some producers want to be legally allowed to add French grapes to their Brunello, but so far that legislation hasn't passed. People have said, no, we want to keep Brunello 100% Sangiovese, which I think is definitely the right decision. The trouble with a lot of Italian wines, certainly in central Italy and Tuscany, is they all allow the French grapes. You know, Chianti allows it, all the wine.
It's about 20% for Chianti, isn't it?
I mean, Chianti, Montecuco, I mean, virtually every red wine that you care to think of in Tuscany allows Morellino di Scanzano. Morellino is another clone of Sangiovese from the coast, from Grosseto province. If Brunello goes their way, there's no USP for Brunello. Brunello's USP is it is made from one grape variety, which is Sangiovese, which we call Brunello in our little town. Yeah. And I think that would be an absolute travesty if they shoot themselves in the foot and vote to allow French grapes. I mean, the good thing about the Brunello scandal, I think, is that it really has prompted a rethink in the zone about to make wines that critics like, which are deep in sort of deepish in colour, but and riper and sexier almost in flavour. We need to improve our viticulture, and there really is a strong move in the zone now to really get to grips with that. And I think every cloud has a silver lining. I really do think we're in for some really exciting times in Montalcino. I really do, genuinely.
Okay, you're based around Montalcino, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's because I live there and I see it. But I mean, when I arrived there, I mean, it was very hard to find a vineyard that had any grass in it, you know. And now that's really changing. And I was very vociferous about that, being quite a lippy character when I arrived. I said, look, I don't feel it's possible for these wines that are deeply coloured to issue from these vineyards that have no grass in. There's no organic matter in these vineyards. So something for me didn't add up. Anyway, the scandal happened. And what I've been saying to producers is, you need to put some life back in your soil. You need to put some organic matter back in there so that the soils can breathe a bit. If the soils can breathe, they can absorb any rainwater that falls. There'll be less heat stress. Less heat stress means you get more even ripening. You get more flavours in your wine. And they're much easier to ferment. And they age better because the tannins are more stable. All you got to do, guys, is make some good quality compost. And then you can start even cover cropping, which is sowing green plants between the vines.
One of the wines that some people think is actually a better quality wine than Brunello di Montalcino is Vino Nobile di Montepulciano, but it's not really. People, you know, it just sounds better because it's Vino Nobile di Montepulciano.
Yeah, Vino Nobile. I mean, that was the reason for that was it was a sort of wine for the nobles.
Yeah.
Vino Nobile di Montepulciano. It's complicated. There's the central Italian grape called Montepulciano, which is further east. And then Vino Nobile di Montepulciano is another Sangiovese-based wine, which can also contain French grapes. And the terroir there is... it's a little bit sort of the soil is a little bit heavier, it's a little bit more continental climate, you're a little bit further away from the sea, so you do kind of get wines that are quite sort of robust. But again, I think that's a region that has some very, very, very exciting producers in it at the moment. They have a lot of little micro terroirs, and I think they tend to work them pretty well.
You mentioned it's a bit further inland. Just to recap, Montalcino, it's inland a bit, but there's a valley that runs all the way, and so it gets cold air being brought in, is that right?
Not really. It's about 25 miles, 40 kilometres away from the sea.
Yeah. Isn't it the Orca or...?
Orcher. That's the Orcher River, yeah.
Yeah, so you've got the Orcher River.
And the Ombrenia.
But doesn't that bring cold air up?
Not really. What you have is you have Montalcino is like a sort of pyramid, a town, a very high town, strategically very important in the Middle Ages, on the north side and the south side. The north side tends to be a little bit cooler, partly because of the actual town itself blocks that warmer sea air coming in during the day, so it tends to be a little bit cooler. The south side tends to be a little bit warmer. There are microclimates within that, but generally you could say a Brunello from the south side of Montalcino is going to taste a little bit lusher, probably have a little bit more alcohol compared to Brunello from the north side of Montalcino, which will possibly be a little bit more aromatic and possibly a little bit more intense. But that is a pretty, I'm not saying one is better than the other, actually. I'm just saying they're a little bit different.
Do they blend across them?
Good question. Yeah, a lot of producers do have vines on both sides, actually. And so there's this big debate in Montalcino now about whether they should zone. It's a very big village, actually, a very big commune, whether they should do what the Burgundians have done. And some producers are fearful that, my vineyard will be classified like as a village and my neighbours will be classified as a Grand Cru. So there's a little bit of resistance there at the moment. But it's like a game of chess, understanding Brunello. I've been there for a while. I still don't fully understand it. Because, as you say, there's so much sort of inter-regional blending going on.
Okay.
Legal, as I'm talking about. Legal.
Exactly. Okay, so we touched on the Super Tuscans earlier and Sassicaia. Probably the key thing from that is that they were on the coast, aren't they? They're on the left-hand side of the coast, so you get a lot of coolness coming in. Is that the reason they started growing Cabernet Sauvignon, or...?
Yeah, no, I think probably the reason was this: the landowners, the people who started doing these, like the sort of noble families, actually owned a lot of land there. Some of these nobles, dating from the sort of 15th century, owned fantastic amounts of land there where they would go hunting, and they just happened to have it on the coast. And the idea there on the coast is you can get this sort of maritime influence into your vineyard. You've also got some very interesting soils that can be quite rich in clay. So even though it's hot, your vine should be able not to stress too much because it can find water there. So you can get these wines that are very, very intense and quite aromatic as well. And again, this idea, I mean, because it worked in Bulgari, where Sassicaia is, that whole coast now has become a bit of a mecca for people planting international grape varieties. And as with all things, some people do it well and some people don't.
So there's a range down there in Bulgari?
Yeah, you have, there's some interesting, Cabernet Franc looks pretty good. I think some Syrah looks very, very good down there. For white wines, some people have tried Chardonnay, but I think it's too hot, ripens too quickly. Vermentino is a traditional grape, and that ripens much better. Then you go further south, you're down into Scanzano, Marolino di Scanzano, which has to be a minimum of, I think, 75% Sangiovese or 85% Sangiovese, but you can put French grapes in that. So that can be a bit of a mishmash. My favourite Marolino is generally 100% Sangiovese, because they're more interesting.
Yeah.
Anybody can stick Bordeaux grapes into their wine.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's true. Just one thing on that. Sasakaya has actually got their own appellation now, haven't they? It's Bulgari Sasakaya.
That's right, yeah.
Is it different, or is it just because they were there first that they managed to get a DACG?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know the politics behind it. I would imagine that because they've been making this, you know, terroir-specific wine for a long time, they've got their own appellation, and you know, good luck to them. But there's a very interesting appellation just south of that now called Suvaretto, and that's now a DOCG as of last year. And the main producers there focus more on Merlot. Mm-hmm. Tuarita is the sort of leading name there. And they make they have these very iron-rich soils, and they can make Merlots that have really, really interesting textures.
Let's keep going with the white wines now from around the Tuscany area.
I haven't done Montecuco.
Oh, okay. What is Montecuco?
Okay, Montecuco is basically on the south side, where Montalcino ends on the south. You have Montecuco, which is Montecuco, which is the sort of high part of the coastal hill before you get right down to the coast. Then you get to Marolino di Scanzano, and then you hit the Mediterranean. And what's interesting about Montecuco is you have really good night cooling. They're quite elevated, these vineyards. Generally have a real mix of soil. But you can get quite a firm style of Sangiovese, sort of quite a hearty, firm style of Sangiovese.
So you got nice, holding on to a lot of acidity in the Sangiovese?
Yeah.
Was that hard in the tannins a wee bit?
A little bit. I mean, you could say they're less exotic, perhaps, than Tuscan reds from sort of lower-lying areas, but they do have a little bit more beef to them.
All right, let's talk about the whites now. In Tuscany, what is it?
Vernaccia, or Vernaccia di San Gimignano. Basically, Vernaccia di San Gimignano means Vernaccia, which is a grape from the town of San Gimignano. And it's a dry white wine. You can add 10% now of Chardonnay to it if you want to.
But what does Vernaccia taste in its own right?
Well, it's funny, actually. What does Vernaccia... I mean, some people say that it's called Vernaccia because it tastes of varnish. It doesn't really. It's a little bit... It's not particularly aromatic. It's sort of medium-bodied. It's similar in weight to Chardonnay, a little bit tighter and a little bit more herbal.
Yep.
But what's interesting about Vernaccia di San Gimignano is you're seeing a move away from really technical winemaking, everybody fermenting cool with the same kind of brand of yeast. People are taking a few more risks and being a little bit more experimental now. So I think we've yet to see the best from Vernaccia di San Gimignano.
Okay, so everybody's more formulaic, and now they're just, what, wild ferments, or...?
Not yet. I mean, that is starting to happen, and roll on, I say.
Okay, good one. All right, and then that's sort of the main... Oh, no, we missed Marche. Well, where is Marche first?
So that's on the Adriatic coast.
Below
Emilia-Romagna. It's between Emilia-Romagna and Umbria, north of Abruzzo, yeah. And the Marche, the most famous wine in the Marche, or Marche region, is Verdicchio de Castelli di Jesi. And Jesi is a town. Castelli means castle. So it's Verdicchio, grape, white wine, from the town of Jesi, where there are lots of castles. That's really what the name means. It's a real mouthful.
I tell you what, I've actually managed to pronounce that now. Of all the Italian regions, that's the one I struggled the most. And I went out of my way to get it right. And I'm not going to say it now, but usually... Well,
yeah, in Italian, the J is a yay. It's a di Jesi. And it's a dry white wine. You know, it's a kind of classic one for seafood. They used to sell it in these kind of funky amphora-shaped bottles.
Not with wicker like the old Chianti
no,
ones.
most people have stopped doing that now. But yeah. Again, it's a good sort of seaside wine. And you've got some very interesting terroirs there as well. You've got to think about how close you are to the coast, which way the vines are facing. And that will influence how quickly the vines ripen and how dense the wine is going to be. But again, there's some good stuff going on.
And typical style?
Well, as I said, dry white. Slightly creamy. A little bit less firm than the Vernaccia, quite sort of broad open textured wines, not particularly dense. You've got quite sandy, quite sort of friable soils there, so you don't really have a lot of density in the wine, but you can get some wines with decent amounts of finesse.
Price points, because I always think of them as not particularly expensive, more in the lines of the Montepulciano or Abruzzo or something like that.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you know, these wines that sort of end up, they're sort of brands in supermarkets almost. You know, you can put Frascati in there, Valpolicella. It's really hard for producers to rise above that and price their wines differently, because they're making more of an effort in the vineyard. Either they declassify the wines and give them fantasy names, but you know, I mean, if you go to a good Italian restaurant and they give you the top Verdicchio from a producer that really works well, it'll be a delicious wine. You just have to pay a little bit more for it, but I think that's better value for money than some cheap Verdicchio that tastes like well, it tastes like creosote.
Yeah. Okay.
And the wine we didn't pronounce was Cornero and Rosso Piceno.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So let's talk about them then. What is Cornero?
Well, they're both based on the Montepulciano grape.
So red wine.
Yeah, sorry. So the Cornero and Rosso Piceno are both... there's probably slightly denser examples of the Montepulciano grape red wine than you find a little bit further south in Montepulciano d'Abruzzo.
Okay.
Maybe with not quite as much finesse in the best examples.
To be honest, I always find... I know Montepulciano can, as a grape variety, can have structure and acidity, yeah. But the ones I tend to buy are down the cheaper end. And they're nice wines, but they always remind me of more of a slightly more structured, generic Merlot-type style rather than, say, a Chianti style, Sangiovese style.
Yeah, I mean, it's like with Chianti. You can get really fruity Chianti or really serious Chianti. You can get really fruity Montepulciano, and you can get really quite serious Montepulciano. D'Abruzzo Reds, and again, it's all about knowing the producer. Producers that lower their yields, that farm really, really well, allow the grapes to ripen fully, are going to make wines that have that roundness and ripeness of tannin and that natural density, and growers that just go for yield will give you a cheaper bottle of wine that's perfectly pleasant, but it's not really going to stimulate your brain.
Okay. Let's move into Montepulciano Abruzzo now. Mm-hmm. So again, we've just talked about Montepulciano as a grape variety. Mm-hmm. Stylistically, we've talked about it can be firm or softer. What would you say is a classic style for the wine?
Well, Montepulciano d'Abruzzo, I think a classic style is it's generally medium bodied. It's got generally plenty of colour. It's quite frank in terms of the fruit expression, so mainly sort of black fruits. Mm-hmm. Not that exotic, not like we're talking really exotic blackberry fruits or black cherry, but you kind of get some, and you get some sort of savoury leather tones when the wine ages for a couple of years. But most of it is made to be drunk young. As I said earlier on, a wine from a really good producer will age between 1 and 6 or 7 years and will develop some fantastic flavours, as I said, leather, maybe slightly tarry. But again, you know, good drinking wines.
Yeah, okay. Is there anything else down there?
Well, and...
Oh, Trebbiano.
So, right, well, I mean, the thing about Trebbiano d'Abruzzo, it's a dry white wine. I mean, Trebbiano, there are, like Sangiovese, lots of sub-varieties of Trebbiano, some good and some not so good. Generally speaking, Trebbiano d'Abruzzo is really a gluggable, simple, crisp, fairly neutral white wine, and yeah, that's the best you can say about it. Slightly herbal, you get almost a slight nose of I drank one today actually, of aniseed to it. Yeah. In the best examples, but generally there's only one producer really that makes a really serious example of Trebbiano, and he makes them from traditional pergola vines, which are sort of like an overhead vines, and but very old vine, so his wine is very distinctive. And actually, his wine is called Trebbiano d'Abruzzo. It's made from a grape called Bombino Bianco, just to make everybody really confused.
Oh, okay. So he's allowed to call it a Trebbiano d'Abruzzo, which is Trebbiano from Abruzzo, but it's a different grape variety. That'll be Italian. I notice you wave your hand there.
That's a whole other program, you know, going through these grape varieties. But Trebbiano d'Abruzzo, it's slightly herbal, slightly licorice-y, dry white. And just usually made for glugging.
We start into Umbria, which...
You're moving actually into the centre of Italy.
Yeah, so maybe we go south into Abruzzo.
Yeah.
Umbria, I actually went and stayed in Umbria a few years ago, and we had a look around some of the wine regions. Actually, I spent most of the time driving into Montepulciano, Montecino, then hanging out in Umbria. Again, Sangiovese?
I mean, I think the most interesting wines from Umbria are the white wines, Orvieto, which is a dry white and made from not interesting grape, Trebbiano, Malvasia, which I think can be very interesting, Verdello and Grechetto. And you get sort of green limey fruits in the best examples of Orvieto. And that area, what's interesting about that area in Umbria is you have quite sort of these very, again, open textured sort of volcanic soils. And you get wines that are sort of quite full in the mouth, but they're not heavy. And I find that that's for me the most interesting.
Was that fruit weight or something?
It's not really. There's more savoury. It's not really kind of these really exotic fruit. I mean, there's slightly exotic, but not sort of overpoweringly peachy flavours. It's a little bit more subtle than that. And but again, Orvieto, the cheap examples, like a brand in a supermarket, are not very interesting. If you find one from a really good producer, you're going to get something that has a little bit of weight and density to it. Very, very savoury white wines. And because you're sort of in the middle of Italy here, you've got a slightly more continental climate. You're at higher altitudes as well. You get a little bit more rain there. They call Umbria the green heart of Italy. So you're generally getting wines that have that real inner freshness that you don't always find from wines nearer the coast, where actually it generally tends to be hotter.
And then moving south, we're into Lazio.
Yeah, well, Lazio, but that's basically where Rome is.
Yeah.
And the main wine, the drink of the Romans is Frascati.
Yep.
And which is another dry white, and it normally has slightly yellow colour. But what you've seen in recent years is a lot of these vineyards have been taken out for housing because the land is worth so much more.
Yeah.
And also, you do tend to get a little bit of pollution around there. To be honest, I don't want to be down on anybody, but every time I go down to Rome, it's always a bit of a haze over that area, which is a bit of a shame.
Frascati is I think of it as a very simple, fresh white wine.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think of it as anything other than that. Have I been a bit naive or not spending enough money? Or
no, I think what's interesting about it generally is I think it's sort of quite a narrow wine in a way. It's made, the main grape is Malvasia, and that gives us a slightly yellowy wine. Again, it can be sort of slightly balsary, savoury, maybe a little slightly exotic, a little bit orangey as well sometimes at its best. But again, generally most of it is made by co-ops and it's to be glugged.
Yeah. Yeah, so nothing too exciting.
Well, again, the best producers, as with all things, do go the extra mile and make something with a little bit more concentration and texture.
Just before we close up, Monty, what is your favourite style of wine from Central Italy? Yeah, maybe a region, producer, whatever. What really do you enjoy?
Well, I have to say,
and it can't be your own wines.
No, the one next one I'm going to make won't be in Italy. But my favourite wine is something that's really well grown in Brunello. It just has that extra class, complexity, width, length, everything. And the tannins can be really, really complex. It's a really pleasurable thing to drink, really interesting thing to drink. And I generally prefer wines from the higher altitudes of Montalcino, where you get slightly slower ripening. And you get wines that have that just that little bit more length and elegance. So I would have to say Brunello.
What do you mean by complex tannins?
Well, you can if you think about eating a grape that's like a raisin, you know, you chew it and it's gone almost. And if you think about it, or an apple that's just got ripe and you crunch into that, there's all sorts of stuff going on in your mouth. And that's, I guess, the difference between a wine that's ripened really quickly and that doesn't really have a story to tell. There's no story of the season behind it. Whereas if you've got a wine that's ripened slowly, up on a slightly higher site that gets a bit cooler at night, it's really had to work to get ripe, because all it's trying to do is ripen its seeds to make babies. That's going to have a much more interesting story to tell in the glass than a wine that's ripened 3 weeks earlier.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Monty. I appreciate your time.
No probs.
Cheers. I'm going to top and tail it because I'm going to split that in half.
Yeah.
All right. So, hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Monty. How are you, Monty?
I'm pretty good, thanks, Chris.
Excellent. We're going to crack on talking about Central Italy. It's one of those wine regions that, you know, it's people know about, but there's a lot of sub-regions in Central Italy that aren't really that common. So let's talk about, I'll work out how to put it together, don't worry. And thank you very much, Monty.
No problem.
Cheers, bud.